This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, the Midwest Murder Podcast is going on tour, and we talk with one of the hosts and one of the writers of that podcast. But we're going to start with storytelling of a vastly different type. The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. I'm guessing a lot of you already have nice memories that start to perk up just thinking about your first exposure to this classic American book and film. There is a new documentary premiering tonight on PBS stations at 8 o'clock Central. It's called American Oz, and it's part of the American Experience program. It explores the life of author L. Frank Baum, including the time that he spent in Dakota Territory and how that shaped his books. We visit with filmmaker Randall McLowery. Randy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Do you remember, was there kind of a one moment, or is it a lot of things coming together that attracted you to the story of the wizard behind The Wizard of Oz?
I would say I was always interested in The Wizard of Oz. It was a very seminal moment for myself as a young boy. Like many who were growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, the introduction to The Wizard of Oz was through the television broadcast that happened around Thanksgiving. I could relate to two things that were in our film. One, I was terrified by the flying monkeys. And two, we had a black and white television set. So for the longest time, I had no idea that when Dorothy entered the world of Oz, it was a wonderful, beautiful Technicolor world. When American Experience came to Tracy and myself to see if we were interested in doing a film about L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, we were excited by that opportunity. And when I found out that the book was published in 1900, I recognized that this was a transformative time in American history, and that exploring, you know, what would have been the individual and what his life would have been like leading up to that moment in time at the cusp of, you know, modern America would be quite exciting.
Yeah, I want to talk about that female power and agency and strength. How does Dorothy, as a protagonist, compare with other female characters within the canon of literature up till that point?
Well, I would say, first of all, I'm not a literature scholar.
Sure.
So but you know, I think that in terms of what Dorothy did, I mean, there were precedents, you know, of female protagonists prior to that time. You had certainly Alice and Alice in Wonderland, and around the time you had Little Women and so on. But, you know, I think what Dorothy was it represented very much this American can-do spirit. Mm. And embodying that in a female character was very empowering at the time. And I think Frank Baum really was inspired by the women that were around him, both his wife, Maud Baum, his mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage. And Matilda Jocelyn Gage was a fascinating and formidable character. And she was one of the early leaders of the suffrage movement, along with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She was a real intellectual and a progressive, and I think she really brought a lot of inspired Baum to sort of reach into places he would not normally have thought about. His wife Maud had been an undergraduate at Cornell, one of the few women that were in university, into colleges at that time, and so she really was an independent individual, independent spirit as well. And so these things, I think, were very important for influencing Baum as he started to think about and imagining worlds outside of the everyday world, which is really what his power came through, was his sense of imagination. And he creates a world in Oz that is very much of a matriarchal society. And Dorothy is this very straightforward and practical and individual that kind of keeps putting, as it says in the film, one foot in front of the other, down the yellow brick road to get what she needs, which is to get home.
Yeah, and he had that strong female protagonist in his books, but he also, in his real life, outside of, writing fantasy, he was an early suffragist himself, and he was encouraging of women, but also, of course, of men, because at that time, they were the ones who were able to vote. How does that compare with the prevailing attitude of the time?
There were many men that were supportive of the suffrage movement at that time. I think, you know, he was actually, you know, in Dakota Territory and was very involved
right.
with the vote in 1890 when South Dakota had just become a state and whether they were going to allow women the vote. And he was a very strong proponent. At that time, he was on his second career in the Dakota Territory, having started as a store owner of Baum's Bazaar, and then that had failed with the onset of the drought at that time. And he quickly transitioned, he pivoted, as they say, took control of a newspaper, the Aberdeen Saturday Pioneer, and he was very vocal about supporting the suffrage movement and really encouraged and tried to make the argument for men to vote for that. And he really put his heart and soul into that and was very hopeful for it. In the end, he was not successful, which mm-hmm. I think was disappointing for him. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at, you know, in Aberdeen at the time when he was there, you know, the individuals that were on the sort of the suffrage committee were both men and women. And so there were progressive strands in Aberdeen as throughout the country. And he wasn't sort of the lone person out there working towards it, but he was definitely outside of, you know, what would have been obviously what was the sentiment at the time in Dakota Territory. And so in that respect, he was definitely very much of a bit ahead of his time.
It was very interesting to me in the documentary that he was ahead of his time when it comes to women's rights, but he was very much, and I hate using this phrase because I think it kind of whitewashes over history, what you would call a man of his times when it comes to race relations and very specifically what was being done with the indigenous people of the U.S. and specifically of the Dakota Territory. You have a section in the documentary that talks about him using his power in the newspaper to call for an annihilation of the indigenous people. To carry within one person this progressive attitude towards women and a very regressive attitude towards race.
Frank Baum, like many people, was a complex individual, and this was a time there was a lot of complex sentiments and thoughts going on around Native Americans. You know, America, in essence, was built on racism. I mean, and in this way, it was also at this time was also a time of growing racialization. So it was I understand you not wanting to call him a man of his time. I mean, mm-hmm. in terms of thinking about that, in terms of whitewashing it, but you know, he was, as one of our interviewees says, he was channeling a sentiment of how white Americans viewed Native Americans at that time. And, you know, this is a time of what was considered, you know, expansion within America and what was conceived as progress, quote unquote. And Native Americans were not seen on as equals for many people in America at that time. And as we discussed in the documentary, to some degree, they were seen as an afterthought in relationship to their stewardship and how their stewardship of the land. It was very different. And so it was seen as, and for Frank Baum, I mean, he came out to Dakota Territory with the hopes of, as he says in one of his letters, that becoming somebody. This was his sort of the creation of his dream, which was to become successful out there. And he's been thwarted by the drought, which has ruined his store. And now there's this rising tension around the Indian scare, as it's called. And there's this ratcheting up of in the headlines of potential raids and things like that. And there's some incidents that happen that lead to kind of a very threatening moment. And he turns to this very hateful language. You know, many people thought the extermination of Native Americans was an inevitable process that would take place. And So he was part of numerous strands of American thought about this, and that doesn't, you know, dismiss his tolerance of women and his progressive attitudes. And as one of our interviewees says, we all carry, as settlers, this element of racism in us, and it's still obviously something that's very much with us today in continuation of the American society.
Do you think that our approach to documentaries is changing in the scope of an increased understanding of how this land came to be a country?
I would hope so. I think there are documentaries and other mediums that are looking into understanding and investigating the history and reinvestigating kind of, you know, the history, and what we assume to be a truth or not is always important. And the history that is often told is told by those that are in power. So I think there is a shift that's happening with that, and I think that is something that does create greater understanding about the totality of our country and the society.
You are the co-founder of a group called The Film Posse, and this is a film company that, according to the website, seeks to tell stories that talk and specifically challenge our ideas on race, identity, gender, sexuality, health disparities, science and technology even. And I'm wondering, how does a portrait of L. Frank Baum, as beloved of an author as he may be, he is a white guy from a privileged background, how does a portrait of him fit into that mission?
Well, I think looking at somebody like L. Frank Baum, as we talked about, who is a complex individual, is somebody who has lived, in terms of thinking about, you know, some of the, what's happening in terms of the rise of popular culture, he's very much a part of it, that he is somebody who presents and creates stories that are well-loved and beloved, and we have become sort of part of the American tapestry, certainly with the wonderful Wizard of Oz. It's also important to look at the corners of his life and to understand where he's coming from, because it gives us a better sense of America as a whole. Mm-hmm. I think to understand, you know, I think that it's helpful to explore sort of what was happening, you know, in terms of the turn of the 20th century and thinking about race, and where there were moments where perhaps he might have used stereotypes. It's not to say that his story and his creations aren't not inspirational and transformative and are very, very powerful, and they are present a wonderfully optimistic story and an optimistic sense of self and empowerment that I think many, many people tap into, not just in America, but across the world. And so it's really trying to capture the fuller tapestry of a human life and what you can learn from that when you explore a life like that. And I think it's very helpful to sort of to touch upon aspects of his life that are not perhaps directly as connected to the what everybody knows about the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that he was very much the kind of guy who just threw himself into anything. He was an enthusiastic writer for poultry journals, chicken breeding, and he did some oil sales, and he ran the novelty store you mentioned, Baum's Bazaar. He really put himself into whatever he was doing, it sounds like.
He certainly did. I mean, he went at everything 100%. You know, in that respect, he was kind of a quintessential American in terms of his sense of confidence and also his sense of reinvention, the idea that he kind of, he was innovative in that way, and I think he was willing to take risks. I think that's an important part of his personality, an important part of what he represents about America, that it was through that sort of continual reinvention that he really ends up finding himself. But he always is true to, I think, what really made him tick, which was his belief in and understanding of the power of imagination, and it was his superpower. And I think he wanted to share that in any way that he could. And he was excited when he was, you know, he was writing the Oz books, and he would get letters back from children who were fans of Oz, and they were offering up their ideas of characters that should be added to the stories, and were presenting things. And I think he really I think he was quite thrilled with the fact that he was, you know, encouraging that kind of thinking and kind of imagination in the boys and girls that were reading his books. And I think in that way, I think he really took a lot of gratification from the work that he was doing and really understood that to be important.
Well, let's talk about that power of imagination. And you mentioned already that he spent quite a lot of time in the middle parts of this country in Dakota Territory and some time in Kansas after growing up from a fairly privileged background on the East Coast. And The Wizard of Oz, of course, that tornado is a character unto itself. And there's a line in the documentary, and I'm paraphrasing, that the geography of the Midwest can either kind of wear a person down. You can get overwhelmed by not seeing anything and the bone-chilling cold, or you can step up and meet this expansive sky with an equally large imagination. How much do you think, can you say it would have been a very different book if he hadn't spent time in this part of the country?
It is always speculative to make a guess like that, but I certainly feel like that, you know, his time in Dakota was very formative, and in the Dakota Territory and then South Dakota. He did not live in Kansas. He did pass through there in some of his travelings as a salesman and during his tour on as an actor with his production of The Maid of Erin.
Just enough time for the wife to say, we'll never live here, right?
to feel like this is a bleak and dreary place, doesn't want to live there. But Dakota Territory and the Plains and the Great Plains were very obvious influences for certainly the creation of Kansas and the drought that he witnessed. I mean, he was not a farmer. He was a store owner. He lived in town, but he went to Aberdeen, and he had his wife's siblings lived there. He had two sisters-in-laws and a brother-in-law in the Dakota Territory, and one of them kind of lived outside of Aberdeen on a farm, and he saw and witnessed the struggles that these settlers were going through. And when the drought hit and, you know, the dreams are ripped away, I think that does create the grayness of Kansas that is seen in the first chapter of The Wizard of Oz. And that resonated, I'm sure, quite a bit with people in 1900 when they read that. And that's, you know, the idea. He did pull, you know, he was using influences from America to tell his story. So I think in that respect, Dakota is, you know, the wide open horizon. It does think is an expansive place to be. It does have a different feel than being on the East Coast and kind of feeling perhaps at times more closed in. So I think for some people, that sense of expanse and possibilities is something that can feed the imagination. And certainly the cyclone, which was part of that experience of living out there, you know, certainly plays a part, and as it's so well told in the film, that instead of transforming it into something negative and deadly, that this cyclone transforms it into something positive, and it takes her out of the gray of Kansas and into the color of and the wonder of Oz.
Well, another thing that he kind of turns on its face is the whole concept of witches. Am I correct in thinking that up until The Wizard of Oz, most of the stories about witches were that witches were, they were always bad. And here, all of a sudden, we have the idea that a witch can be good?
Yes, I think that the idea of the good witch is definitely something that is something that we can, if not attribute directly to him, but he certainly, you know, he makes that a character and that is unusual for the time and sort of and I think, as we indicate, that the thinking about that, you know, would have been part of the inspiration coming from his mother-in-law Matilda Jocelyn Gage and what she writes about in one of her books in terms of how witches were seen as evil and were seen as, and they're persecuted, but part of the reason they're being persecuted is because they're actually women that have knowledge.
Right.
And so that she, you know, sees the duality in how women are being perceived as being these either satanic and demonic creatures, but also understanding that, you know, women have intelligence and knowledge and power. And that, so that I think that those are the things that helped, you know, influence Baum to thinking about that you would present these two different sides to a witch in these fairy tales, and so witches obviously were part of fairy tales in the past, and oftentimes with the European fairy tales, they tended to be much more dark and gloomy, and his tale is much more optimistic and hopeful.
Another speculative question. Which character in The Wizard of Oz do you think that he most identified with?
You know, it's hard. I think that there would be, he probably finds himself in all the characters there.
Yeah.
I think there are elements of The Wizard that certainly relate to some of Baum's own experiences in terms of, you know, Baum in several of his careers was involved with as a salesperson. And so early on when he was working for Baum's Castorine, one of the family businesses, as a seller of axle oil or axle grease, he got involved with trying to learn how to, you know, make something dramatic out of selling axle grease and sort of what you have to present to the public. And obviously Baum's Bazaar, his store in Aberdeen, was this place of trying to transform people through goods, and was about, you know, he was very playful with his ads that he wrote in the paper, and it was really kind of turning this store into sort of a place of imagination, and sort of a stage for him to present magical goods that perhaps would help bring a lot of joy to people. And then later in life in Chicago, where he was a traveling salesperson and going from place to place and trying to get people to buy china and glass and crockery. And so I think that there's an aspect of understanding the art of the sell, which in some ways, you know, the wizard is presenting, you know, something that isn't. And, you know, it's about creating, you know, it's a bit of an art of deception. And so, and Baum actually wrote about that in one of his articles in when he was the editor of Aberdeen Saturday Pioneer. So I think that there's an aspect of that in him playing with that, and that comes up in the. Well, I don't know that I wouldn't say that Baum saw himself as a humbug, as a wizard claims to be, but I think Baum understood the world of humbug, and you know, this is the time when you had. Barnum was, you know, very popular, so there was this sense of using deception as a way to lure people to purchase something or to come to an event or things like that. So there's, so I see an aspect of him in that character.
What character do you see the most of yourself in?
Oh, good gosh, I don't know. I had never thought about that.
You said you're afraid of the flying monkeys, so I'm guessing not those.
I'm afraid of the flying monkeys, but. You know, I don't know. I guess thinking back about the movie, I was always a not to impugn my intelligence, but I always liked the Scarecrow.
What was it about the Scarecrow?
Oh, I don't know. I think it probably was just his. It was more about the dancing and the numbers that he did. I don't
bring a little joy to the world.
Bring a little joy. That's right.
Yeah, it's a hard gift to give.
But they're all wonderful characters. I mean, I think that the what he captures in the Dorothy and her trio of companions is a really delightful sense of in friendship. And I thought that what really is wonderful in terms of what he presents in terms of that and through community. And I think it was important for him too. Through community is where you gain your strength as well. Yeah.
Randall, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure, and thank you for speaking to me.
That was filmmaker Randall McLowry. You can watch the documentary American Oz tonight on Prairie Public at 8 o'clock Central. Coming up on Main Street, a true crime podcast hits the road. Midwest Murder is going on tour. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has again passed a bill that limits local law enforcement from assisting federal agents in enforcing federal firearms laws that are more restrictive than state law. The bill does carve out some exceptions. The measure was sent to a conference committee. This would apply to a federal law passed after January 1st of 2021. Bismarck Republican Representative Dave Nearing told the House a bill now pending in Congress would be much more restrictive on gun rights than current law.
In its details, H.R. 127 is so outrageous, persecutory, and unworkable that its main function is simply to display the hostility of its author and supporters towards firearms, those who own them, and those who want to own them. HB 1383 is exactly what we need in North Dakota to keep our constitutionally guaranteed freedoms.
But Rolla Democratic Representative Marvin Nelson argued the bill in Congress will not pass.
If we want to sit here and talk about fantasy bills that'll never pass the House, much less the Senate of the United States, as the reason for what we're doing, we're just living in fear. That's not going to happen. But what's going to happen is we're going to give police officers an untenable situation.
The measure passed 80-12 and will now go back to the Senate to see if it concurs. North Dakota lawmakers could be back as early as this summer to deal with how to spend more than $1 billion from the federal American Rescue Act. The legislature will be holding a December special session to deal with redistricting, and the plan was to use that session to deal with the federal money. But Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says he wants to move quickly once the feds issue the guidelines for spending that money.
We're not using it for ongoing spending. It's going to be used for one-time spending, and we're hoping we can use it for infrastructure. We're hoping we could take care of an unfunded liability in our retirement plan. That would be really a great thing if we can get those two things done.
Wardner says House and Senate Appropriations Committees will be looking at the guidelines once they're issued and will make recommendations to the full legislature. And a bill to change the time in North Dakota has run out of time. The House rejected House Bill 1371. It would have put the entire state on year-round daylight savings time. It would be dependent on Congress okaying it and if Minnesota, Montana, and South Dakota did the same. The bill's main sponsor, Finley Republican Representative Bill Devlin, didn't like the amended version.
I never expected a leader like the state of North Dakota would have to wait for three other states to do something before we could do it.
But Hazleton Republican Representative Jeff Megrim said now's the time to make the change.
This looks like a good option. At least it's better than nothing. And I think if we approve this, the other states will see that and they'll support the change as well.
The vote was 56-36 to kill the measure. The South Dakota legislature was considering a similar measure, but it ran out of time. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Privately run prisons were making a lot of money during the Trump administration because of all the undocumented immigrants being put there. President Biden wants to phase those prisons out, but a lot of the facilities are cutting deals to stay open.
I think what they've proven over the years is that they are resourceful and resilient. They have found ways to keep doing business.
The debate over detention on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Midwest Murder is a podcast that dives into the Midwest's most famous murder cases and what laws might have changed because of some of those crimes. The show is going on tour with stops across North Dakota. We talk about it with Jonah Lanto, who's one of the hosts and writers of the show, and one of the writers and researchers of the Midwest Murder Podcast, Dr. Sean Ann Tangney. Jonah, thanks for joining us today.
I'm really excited to be here, Ashley. It's always a pleasure.
Sean Ann, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us back. We had so much fun the last time. We're really excited to be here again.
Jonah, before we talk too much about the tour and how to make this podcast, where did this idea come from?
Midwest Murder is co-hosted by myself and Don Palumbo, and Sean Ann is part of our team as a researcher and writer on Midwest Murder. So Don previously co-hosted a show that we produced at the Good Talk Network called After the First Glass. It was her and a gentleman by the name of Eric Hansen, and they drank wine and talked about life and social issues, and it was kind of a late night kick back, relax kind of show. So that's how I met Dawn, was in producing After the First Glass. And over time, I got to know her a little bit better. And the idea, she had thrown the idea, have you ever done a true crime podcast at the Good Talk? And at the time I hadn't. I did not have a pre-existing passion or big interest in true crime. It's kind of, as a podcast at then, there's kind of like this, it's like a meme that you start a podcast and do a true crime podcast.
Yeah,
that everybody who jumps into podcasting, they feel like that's their entry point because true crime is so popular. People love it and they want to gravitate toward that. Certainly when I began the Good Talk, I was always open to a variety of ideas and concepts that we could bring forth, but I wasn't gravitating toward true crime until Don kind of planted that seed. And I said, hey, I'm open to it. it would take a lot of time, all these things, right? I hadn't listened to a true crime podcast, so let's do some research. So she planted that seed. About a year later, author CJ Wynn joined me on an episode of Good Talk, and she wrote the book Wilder Intentions about the murder of Angela Wilder in Minot, North Dakota. And having reading her book and then having a discussion with her about true crime sort of ignited my interest in a big way. So there was a spark, and I called Dawn back and I said, hey, I think it's time. Let's do this. Let's meet. Let's map out what an episode of Midwest Murder would look like. How do we make this happen? How do we bring this idea to light? Dawn and I met. We mapped out the outline, and the show started. We spent several weeks researching and understanding how do we do this. And Dr. T was already working with me at the Good Talk, recognizing her incredible talents as a researcher and a writer. I said, hey, do you want to come on board with this? Because I know that I would like help in building this, and I would like somebody to assist and navigate the research and build these stories.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, Sean Ann, Dr. T here, because that role of researching, Jonah said, if you're going to have a podcast, it should be a true crime podcast. And even just anecdotally, I told my boss I was doing an interview on a true crime podcast. And he said, oh, Dakota Spotlight. And I said, no, the other one. I'm doing a different one, because there are so many. It's very, very popular. So the double-edged sword of that is, okay, you know people like this kind of content, but you also have to set yourself apart from what else is out there. And a lot of the comments seem to stem to be, there's kind of this combination of you need the hostiness between Jonah and Dawn, but you also need that element of what different kinds of research bring to a show like this. So, Sean Ann, what is your approach to researching cases that are sometimes 50 years old?
Yeah, we're very lucky here in North Dakota in that if we are doing cases that are, you know, sort of from the modern era, anytime in the last 50 years or so, it's very easy to get records, right? North Dakota is an easy open record state, and we rely almost exclusively on actual legal documents. Transcripts of trial testimony, transcripts of interviews with witnesses or with suspects themselves, police investigative reports, crime scene photographs. That's been something I never thought I would do in my life, is look at some of the horror that I've looked at in the past 4 or 5
right.
months. So we try to stick as much as we can to the actual legal facts and documents of the case. We do read news stories. We do read what other people have written about cases. And some of the cases that are quite old, like Dawn did an episode on the Wolf family murders, which right. I think was in the 1920s. Obviously, there aren't electronic records available for those. And so we do rely on other media. But we really pride ourselves on doing very careful and very thorough research that comes right from the actual legal sources.
There is a tour with stops in Minot, Bismarck, Fargo, Dickinson, Fergus Falls, and Grand Forks. And you can find those dates and get tickets on Facebook. Why do you want to take this show on the road?
As I reflect on storytelling myself, I often wonder, is it the original art form? After fire, what happened? People gathered around the fire, and then what? Somebody had a story to tell, even when it was just grunts, right? That, and so I feel to a degree when people want stories. People love to hear stories. Movies are stories. A TV show is a story. Documentaries are a story. And so is Midwest Murder. It's what we are doing. And so there's a thrilling process to not only be the person capable and responsible for bringing those stories to audiences, but to share in that experience with someone next to you, the moments of suspense, because there is a lot of suspense, the moments of horror, the wonder, the questions. Sometimes there's not always a really clear finish to some of these stories. And there's a really neat and engaging process following the live show. Dawn and I host a Q&A with the audience. So whether audience members have questions on our research processes or want to share thoughts and theories or have questions about that specific case. Because sometimes in these stories, you might have 1,000+ pages of data, hours and hours and hours of audio files to read, and there's only so much you can share. Our goal is to have our episodes be approximately 60 minutes, maybe give or take 10 minutes. And I know there are some murders that we've covered, Gordon Call, for example, very proud of the work that we did on that episode. There's a documentary on Gordon Call that's 16 hours long. We have to take that information and make it a compelling and factual story and bring it into our format of about an hour, hour and 10 minutes. So taking it on tour, it really is about growing our audience. It's about sharing these stories. And I think in big part, it's bringing storytelling back to the people.
Jonah, I notice throughout Midwest Murder, there is a fair amount of, I guess, what I would just sort of call stream of consciousness thinking on your part. You are obviously very personally, emotionally impacted by some of the things that you're hearing. To some extent, you and Don talk about what's possibly has changed. For example, schools are now primary reporters if they suspect abuse and things that could change. But I'm wondering, was that the intention or what was the goal of this podcast?
That's another great question. And I'll speak for Dawn here. And perhaps at a future date, you can chat with Dawn because she was really passionate about bringing to light the changes in a lot of the processes to law enforcement and reporting, as you mentioned. So for Dawn, that was very much her inspiration. Getting into Midwest Murder was not only personally, she very interested and fascinated and having a lifelong interest in true crime, her words, but that was a major goal of hers and some of the cases that she wanted to cover that changed processes or where new processes were introduced. And for me, sort of reflecting on my previous statement with storytelling, I'm a content creator. I began the Good Talk Network to have amazing perspective-filled conversations, but I was always open to the ideas that might be presented before me. Other shows, other concepts. In the history of the Good Talk, we have done a lot of popular different genres of podcasts. So I feel perhaps it was only a matter of time before I dipped my toes into the true crime world. I'm really grateful I waited until I had a better foundation here at the Good Talk Network, because as I said, it's a little cliche that people just start a podcast and instantly jump into the world of true crime. I don't believe Midwest Murder would be the success it is today had I started out with Midwest Murder as my first podcast. There's just no way. I didn't have the knowledge. I didn't have somebody like Dr. T on my side. I didn't even know Don Palumbo yet. And again, personally, I'm not an enthusiast for true crime. I've watched a ton of really fascinating documentaries, but I don't have a favorite true crime podcast. I listen to NPR and I listen to Snacks Daily and Joe Rogan and The Dollop. And I listen to Midwest Murder because I've got to produce it on the back end. So that's my podcast repertoire.
Well, Seanan, let's talk about this process of researching and writing too, in the sense that, okay, so another show that you work on is the late night style talk show Good Night Live. You are writing comedy for that show. And then you have to kind of go through this process of, is this joke going to land when I give it to the host of that show, Jake? Do you end up with a different approach between how you handle these transitions so that the hosts are good stewards of the work that you're doing?
That's a really good question. And actually, Jonah and I write his episodes together, and Jonah and I have found ourselves to be a sort of marvelously in sync writing team. Mm. We've commented to each other that it's kind of spooky how together we create exactly the voice and tone and cadence and rhythm that Jonah wants to come out of his mouth when he's on the air reading and narrating these stories. I think that comes from a place that that Jonah has already touched on, that both Jonah and I are really in love with the art of storytelling. I don't know, maybe we're just motor mouths and we like to talk, but I used to tell my students, we are the storytelling animal, the human being. You know, I firmly believe that lots of animals have language and communicate with one another, but today we don't know that they tell stories. That's what we do as human beings. And that's sort of been Jonah's and my MO for Midwest Murder. You know, we want to create that atmosphere where we have people's attention completely. And I have to say, it's really thrilling. The last live show we did, getting audible gasps from the audience, because we had them right where we wanted them to be in the story. So it's very, very satisfying. As for writing the two kinds of different things that I do, and you know, I'm writing about four or five different kinds of things at all times. It has been an interesting learning curve of how to write for somebody else to deliver it. I think we're getting pretty good at that, especially with Good Night Live. We're getting to know Jake's tics and tells and preferences, and he's getting to trust that he needs to read what we wrote for him. So it's a big learning curve, but it's really been fun.
We're visiting with Dr. Shaun-Ann Tangney. She is a researcher and writer on the Midwest Murder podcast. And we are also visiting with Jonah Lanto. He is a writer and host and producer on the Midwest Murder podcast. There is a tour with stops in Minot, Bismarck, Fargo, Dickinson, Fergus Falls, and Grand Forks. And you can find those dates and get tickets on Facebook. Jonah, under the umbrella of the Good Talk Network, you have a podcast about education. You talk about nonprofits. You had a conversation with a buddy, you know, once about would you rather be bigger or smaller? You have this murder podcast. You're working on a comedy, late night style talk show. How does Midwest Murder fit into the umbrella of the Good Talk Network?
Given its trajectory, it looks like it wants to take its seat at the top of the umbrella. I tell you what, it's always interesting. I'm a passionate content creator, and as you kind of illuminated, something that's been really cool as the Good Talk has progressed is I've stepped away to a degree from the hosting role in a lot of the things that we are creating, and I'm in a production role, and I really enjoy that, being a writer behind the scenes and working on some of the technical aspects of the audio production. I know that, like, Midwest Murder, I think sounds better than a lot of the things I've ever produced. And it's just because I'm continuing to learn new technique and I adapting to technology. So Midwest Murder, it's got its place. And given that we're taking it on tour and the interest level is so much spread so much further than North Dakota. And a lot of our content has. Good Night Live is appreciated by many people around the country, although it is a regional Midwest focus. And many of our other shows that we've produced in the past, the Game of Thrones cast, for example, our Game of Thrones cast was one of the top 10 listened to Game of Thrones podcasts. I was really proud of that. When Game of Thrones returns next year, we'll probably bring Game of Thrones cast back. And so that's kind of an exciting time. So we're always looking for the opportunities and ensuring that we can put all the puzzle pieces together.
Well, yeah, there is a business to podcasting, and I want to talk about monetizing a podcast, but before that, branding yourself. And I want to hear from both of you. So Shaun-Ann, let's start with you. I think what people don't really understand about branding is how much it impacts what you think about who you are, you know, especially because you're branding yourself as a host, as a writer, as a researcher. What is your approach to branding when you have so many different podcasts and shows that you're working on?
Wow. I hope this doesn't sound horribly conceited, but I think the brand that I wear consistently with all the things I do with Jonah and for the Good Talk Network is I'm going to get the work done. I'm going to be rigorous. I'm going to work all day and all night, and the facts are going to be right. The writing's going to be clean and correct. The joke's going to actually be funny. You know, if people out there in the world see me as, oh, you're the person who does all those different things for the Good Talk, you know, the through line for that for me is consistently on time, correct, and good.
First and foremost, the Good Talk is memorable. Our logo is awesome. The G, the brain inside the brain chat symbol inside the G, people really recognize that. I hope it's iconic someday. And I feel the idea behind the Good Talk was always that we're accepting of and embracing ideas, and we are here to create meaningful content from a variety of perspectives. I might get branded or labeled in certain ways, but I feel that the history of content and the type of guests that we've had over the years on the Good Talk showed very clearly that we're multifaceted and open to a lot of things. But at the heart of what we are doing, it's creating ideas. It's taking ideas and bringing them to life. And that maybe that sounds really big or really silly, but look, I made this in my basement. I didn't even have an intro on my first episode. We didn't know what we were doing. I didn't know how to record anything. I couldn't write comedy. We had a rap battle in our last show. And when I was told we need to write a rap battle, I said, I can't write a rap battle. And 5 minutes later, I had written half of our rap battle. So there's a tenacity and a drive and an ambition behind everything that we do, and a strong will to ensure that it represents who we are as people.
And how do you make money doing this? Or do you?
Lots of different. Well, nobody's running away with bags of money just yet. But there's a variety of ways that podcasters make money. Having a studio, something that is from moving out of the basement and into the full time studio. So we produce content for others. So there are things that we create which we are paid to create. Now we are even now at a position where we can produce live events for other companies. You want an award ceremony for your corporation? We can do everything that involves. We can write an opening monologue for your CEO and help you bring that to life. You just want to hire Goodnight Live as an event for your company? We can do that. Do you need to produce an audio podcast yourself? We can do that. We sell ads on our podcasts. We sell ads on our late night show. How I was making money in the beginning, way different from how I was making money today. In the beginning, it was a lot of affiliate marketing. It was getting people to use my Amazon click portal on my website so that, like, my friends and family, if they would use my Amazon click portal to buy toilet paper or whatever they're going to get from Amazon, I would get a kickback from that. So in the beginning, it was a lot different than how I am doing it now.
Jonah, thanks for your time today.
I really, really sincerely appreciate being here. You are an awesome interviewer, and I appreciate your show a lot.
Shannon, thank you for your time today.
Thank you again for having us on. I echo all of Jonah's compliments. It was lovely to talk to you again.
That was Jonah Lanto, one of the hosts and writers of the Midwest Murder Podcast, and Dr. Shannon Tangney, one of the writers and researchers of the podcast. You can find them on Facebook by searching Midwest Murder and see their upcoming tour dates and get tickets. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 19th. John Eldridge Haggart, Fargo's first town marshal, was born on this date in 1846. Haggart was born in St. Lawrence County, New York. He fought as a Union soldier in the Civil War and lived in Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming before arriving in Fargo in 1871. He settled a few miles southwest of town, and the area became known as the Haggard Stop on the railway, but would later become West Fargo. Haggard farmed extensively and became one of the largest landowners in the state. He was elected as Cass County's first sheriff in 1874, a position he held for the next 12 years. When Fargo became a city in 1875, Haggard was elected town marshal. In 1881, this title was changed to Chief of Police. When Haggard was elected, the city had a population of 600, but no jail, officers, or equipment for a police department. A makeshift jail was rented until a wooden plank jail was erected in 1876. The city spent $197 on its first jail and an extra $8 on its first ball and chain. In 1882, the department was issued their first uniforms. Bicycles were issued to the officers in 1898, and the first squad cars appeared in 1915. Haggard's exploits, however, were not restricted to the police department. He was also elected as chief of the city's fire companies in 1880. And when North Dakota became a state in 1889, he was elected to the first state senate. Senator Haggard's Bill No. 1 was the first bill introduced into the state legislature and the first to become a law. The bill secured state funds for the creation of the North Dakota Agricultural College, which would grow to become NDSU. This was not the end of Haggard's support for the school. He later obtained the land on which the college stands. Haggard even served as the United States Deputy Marshal for North Dakota from 1890 to 1898, then resigned from the state Senate to take the head job as U.S. Marshal. It was a busy life that ended in 1906, when Haggard died at the age of 59. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jamie Job. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is Vera Woodley from Humanities Indy's Game Changer series.
This generation of people, right, we can't make the mistake to think that we can do it on our own. It really has to be about transmitting our values of active citizenship to the generations who come after us as well, so that they are the kinds of people who can act to create the kind of world that we have been striving for.
Vera Woodley talks about social unrest and democracy this Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, a native Nancy Drew. That's what author Angeline Bouley always wanted in a young adult thriller. And that's who she created in the character Donna's Firekeeper, the young protagonist in the new book, Firekeeper's Daughter, which has already been optioned for a Netflix series. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.